Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Well, this week there's an article in The New Yorker, that's the August 25th issue, which is ostensibly a profile of the prominent activist against genetically modified seeds, Vandana Shiva. But this article is so outrageous in so many ways that it has a lot of different groups, communities abuzz, one of them being people who track journalistic standards and journalistic scandals, and the other, of course, the whole activist community that doesn't really think Monsanto and four other companies should own the global food supply. So it's doubly significant, I guess, because it was The New Yorker that helped bring Rachel Carson and her campaign against DDT and other pesticides to the attention of the American public by publishing her essays and part of the book Silent Spring so many years ago in the early 60s. So this time they selected a staff writer at The New Yorker who's written about science. He's a science journalist. But he also wrote a book 5 years ago. And the title of that book is Denialism, : How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. And the author is Michael Spector, the journalist. And in a review of his book in Publishers Weekly, they describe it as his doing, quote, a credible job of demolishing the health claims made by those promoting organic produce and all forms of alternative medicine, unquote. So that's Michael Spector's book and position. If you're not on the side of mechanistic science, you're just irrational. So they assign him this subject, or he probably approached them. And he told Vandana Shiva, she's now released emails, a couple emails between them, back last spring when he was interviewing her, spring and into June. He said, oh, it's going to be a story about globalization and the food supply, and it'll give you ample chance to air your views more fully than has ever been done in a mainstream publication. So she said, well, that would be good. Okay. So then he interviews her and writes the story, and here's the reason, well, one of the reasons is of interest to people who track journalistic skullduggery, because you can tell just at reading it, which I'll get into in a minute, that there's something very strange going on. But the points that he makes and the order in which he makes them were made earlier this year by two articles trashing Vandana Shiva on the Forbes magazine website. They may also have been in their print edition. I don't know. But if you want to put all these in a row, these three, and see what's going on, the one in The New Yorker this week is entitled Seeds of Doubt by Michael Spector. And then you can back up and look at the July 16th issue of Forbes. You can see this online. It's written by a guy from the Hoover Institution, and that one's titled, Wealthy Activist Vandana Shiva is a Poor Advocate for the Poor. But then you can back it up 6 months before that, also on Forbes, and find an earlier one. The title of that one is, Vandana Shiva, Anti-GMO Celebrity, Eco-goddess or dangerous fabulist? And that's in the January 29th, 2014 issue of Forbes. So the thing is, they go through all the hit points, all three of these pieces, in exactly the same order. Okay, start out by saying she's not really a scientist because her PhD is actually in philosophy, which the Michael Spector says in The New Yorker. And he completely hides the information that's on her website right on the homepage, vandanashiva.com. And gives her educational background. So if he would have wanted to put that into the article, he could have explained. She trained, she did graduate level physics studies, trained as a physicist at the University of Punjab in India. And she got, it doesn't even say this here, but I know, she got a master's degree in science with honors in physics. She has a master's degree in physics. And then she did a PhD, and she wrote the PhD on the philosophy of quantum theory. The title of the dissertation is The Hidden Variables in Non-Locality in Quantum Theory, and that was from the University of Western Ontario. And then it says she shifted to interdisciplinary research in science, technology, and environmental policy, which she carried out at the Indian Institute of Science and the Indian Institute of Management. So none of that gets into it. It's just like, oh, you get the impression she's sitting around thinking about Kant for 4 years and has the audacity to put herself out there as a scientist. So that's a little strange, and as I say, it's right in the same spot where the other two articles have it. And then it kind of, you know, makes her look like some kind of substanceless demagogue who travels around roiling up the masses about this non-existent problem with GMO. And he quotes one guy who has just reversed his position. He used to be against GMO, and now he's for it. He said, GMO foods have never killed one person. Right. Well, they've never increased any crop yields either. And they have a real problem now with the resistance of the weeds and the pesticides. You know, in the United States, all that corn and soy that's GMO engineered so that it's Roundup ready and you can use Monsanto's pesticide Roundup along with it. Well, there's been an adaptation, what a surprise, by the weeds. And now those fields are choked with super weeds. And I saw an article last week that some investment fund just pulled out of their Monsanto holdings because of this problem. It's not at all what it was cracked up to be in. But hold that thought about bad science. Anyway, so if you go through this, you'll see, as I was reading it, I said to my husband, I'm only a third of the way through this, but it seems kind of strange. I mean, he uses all these loaded terms, you know, that she has contempt and she can't bear and she'll da-da-da. Everything's very, very loaded. And then he goes and interviews the CEO of Monsanto. Oh, good opportunity. If you're really trying to look at both sides of the debate, you might ask him why so many court cases have gone against them. He doesn't ask him anything like that. And he just writes down for this puff piece that when he asked about these, you know, people who oppose GMO and all these protesters, the CEO sighed and said, "We're a science-based company." So they keep falling back on that. Again, hold that thought. I'm going to come back to that in a second. But anyway, then it goes through that, and I keep waiting. You know, I'm thinking if this is going to be an article about pros and cons of organic versus GMO, you might say, well, this side says, you know, there's been so many increase in yields with new methods of organic farming, and there's a lot of data on that, as well as the difference in nutritional value and the health of the soil, so you actually have a future for farming and feeding people. And then, you know, the other side would say this, well, we don't get more yields, but da-da-da. You would think that he would be presenting what the debate is. But her side never shows up factually, just that she's this, you know, supposedly puffed up eco-queen, which she isn't at all. She's a very hardworking person who is trying to do right for the planet. And so, anyway, I said to my husband, this is kind of strange. And then I got to the quote by, you know, the CEO, and then the last third of the article, I said, oh, my gosh, this just reads like he copied it from press releases from Monsanto. It just goes on and on about the glories of genetically engineered food and no problem and all these problems it's supposedly solving that couldn't have been solved any other way. And, you know, never mind that everybody has to buy every year from Monsanto and all kinds of other things he doesn't mention. So it's really a pretty astounding piece. And I said at the time, how could this have gotten by the editor. I mean, even if the editor didn't even know any of the facts of the debate, you know, anyone could read this and say, this is kind of strange. You know, all your data's on one side. Does this person say anything substantive, the one you don't like, this woman? So anyway, there's one spot in it, and you can look at the whole response to this by Vandana Shiva on her website. It's the first post. There's a menu on the left, and you can go there and see it. And so there's one point where he talks to this guy, Mark Linus, who has, you know, switched sides and now is a big proponent of GMO. And he says, you know, I'm on the side of science and the Enlightenment. And to tell you the truth, I just burst out laughing at that point because I thought, well, there's your problem. 18th century science, you know, things have really moved forward in terms of figuring out dynamic interrelatedness. And she makes that point. I'm very glad she said that in Vandana Shiva's response on her website. Monsanto got the science wrong. They don't understand the ecological science of the evolution of resistance in weeds and pests. So, you know, they keep saying, oh, of course, we tested this. We line up a bunch of flower pots in the greenhouse and originally, right? And we tested it. It was fine. Not the slightest concept of synergistic interactions in the actual environment. And they're just willfully ignorant of this, as if it doesn't matter because we don't want it to matter. So I just think that we shouldn't allow them to keep getting away with saying, you're a bunch of ignorant fools and we have science on our side. Well, they may be clinging to mechanistic science, but really there have been so many discoveries, starting with Einstein's first paper that was published in 1905, more than 100 years of studies, moving science in the direction of understanding the dynamic interrelatedness that constitutes the physical world, including us. And as regular listeners know, I've been very interested in discoveries in physiology in the last just 10 or 12 years about how dynamically interrelated parts of the human body are, the human body with other bodies, with nature, with settings. We really had no idea because we're all schooled in this modern mechanistic worldview. So it's almost like we're in kindergarten now. And I was so thrilled to come across those studies in the media, and then I look on the, you know, website of the science journal they were mentioning, and you can read the abstract there. And I gathered scores of those studies 2 years ago in a book called Relational Reality. And since then, I've kept cutting out more references because these discoveries are happening all the time. It's really a very significant shift. And unlike the discoveries in the 20th century in physics and chaos theory, complexity study that I think people felt maybe were too abstract, it didn't affect them, these discoveries in human physiology are really going into the mainstream very quickly. The way hospital rooms are designed now, that's all coming out of these studies of how our physicality is affected by certain things we look at, relationships, qualities of various relationships. So anyway, that's exciting. That's what happens. That's what's happening now. And that is science. So it's not that they own science at Monsanto and other peers of theirs. Anyway, I am happy to say that my guest today is a pioneer in thinking through what this sort of relational awareness, this relational perspective on reality could mean for one particular area, and that's the area of community design and architecture. My guest today is David Simon, who's a pioneering thinker in research into the area I would call the relational totality of environment-behavior, as it's known. Environment-behavior interface there. His research and writings focus on the ways that the natural environments and the built environments contribute to human well-being. Simon's books include A Geography of the Life World, and then Dwelling, Place, and Environment, which he co-edited, and then Dwelling, Seeing, and Designing, and finally, Goethe's Way of Science, A Phenomenology of Nature, which he co-edited. David Simon holds a PhD in geography, and he's a professor of architecture at Kansas State University. He also edits a wonderful newsletter I just love entitled Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology Newsletter, or EAP, which this year begins its 25th year of publication. So, David Simon, welcome to the program, or I should say welcome back, because you were here 2 summers ago.
Yes, Charlene, thank you. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to start out by commenting briefly on the report you just gave.
Sure, go ahead.
Yes, I think one very important point that underlies your commentary is this question of what it means to understand and what it means to know. And the question of whether conventional, analytic, empirical science is the only way toward true understanding and knowledge. And as you say, today we're beginning to realize that perhaps there are many different ways of taking the path toward understanding. And certainly empirical science is one way, and certainly empirical science is quite wonderful when it deals with the non-living world. There is much major discoveries that comes out of that way of knowing. Very early on in my academic career, I became interested in alternative ways of understanding. And as you say, the tradition that gained my attention most strongly is the phenomenological tradition, which I think we're going to sort of begin with, aren't we?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this reference I read in one of your articles at some point, because it reminded me a little bit of my own experience. I mean, how you encountered this pathway into understanding interrelatedness, the field that's called phenomenology, because, you know, I think you said it explained suddenly things you've been wondering about. And when I was young, I spent 11 summers in the Hocking Hills of southeastern Ohio at a camp, a girls' camp, and it was so beautiful. And everything there felt completely embedded and interrelated. It was a little lake between these two hills, and just the sort of behavior it brought out, it was different from the way kids act at school. I mean, it was so, I don't really have a word for it. But then when we go back up to the city, I would always be struck by, why do things seem kind of off? I mean, just the way things look, the artificialness and the way people act, it just all seemed like it was kind of off the mark of what humans could be, the way we were down in nature. And so I was thinking about that, too, and I didn't encounter phenomenology. I might have made a career choice like you did. But anyway, would you tell us about, you know, how you came to cross paths with this orientation that became the informing perspective of your life work?
Your Ohio example is very, very good, because what it points toward is a major phenomenological principle, and that is that the world in which we find ourselves always embedded contributes to who we are. Let me just say that phenomenology, first of all, is a method. Essentially, phenomenology is the study of human experience. And the argument is that perhaps in the past we really haven't used the grounding of actual experience to understand our existential situation as human beings. And very often when you first read about phenomenology, one of the descriptions you will see is back to the things themselves. In other words, let us return to the phenomena of everyday life, because ultimately they are the beginning an ending point for any more organized or sophisticated study, including scientific research. And the founder of phenomenology, who was a German philosopher named Edmund Husserl, this is really where he started. He felt that the sciences of the time were perhaps moving out of contact with the phenomena that they claimed to study. Mm-hmm. And he felt there must be a new way of looking and understanding that might help us return to the phenomena. So first of all, phenomenology is a method, and one can speak about two steps in the phenomenological process. First of all, bracketing. In other words, we try to set aside what we think we know about the thing that we wish to study. We try to see it with fresh eyes. The pristine innocence of first seeing is one description I love. Let me just say that again. The pristine innocence of first seeing. That's what we're trying to get to. And the method here is what's called bracketing. It's formally called epoche, but we don't need to know that fancy word. Now, besides bracketing, the aim is to begin encountering the thing that we're interested in as openly as possible. The aim is to put the other first as much as we can, and out of that comes what's technically called the reduction. In other words, we begin to see underlying broader patterns of the thing. So phenomenology is a kind of science. If we define science as the search for some kind of order. But of course, the grounding of phenomenology is experience. It's not empirical data that can be measured, reproduced, which is the requirement for analytic empirical science.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, it's a method. Now, it also leads to a way of understanding what our lived relationship is with the world. And this gets us back to your Ohio example. And this is a very important point, the fact that existentially, experientially, we as human beings are always immersed, entrenched, interlocked, interconnected with the world in which we find ourselves. And this has been phrased differently by different phenomenologists. For example, Husserl, the founder, he used terms like life world, natural attitude, horizon, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can get into life world and natural attitude, because to me they're such extraordinary concepts that no other...
What do they mean?
Well, okay, we can get to them now. Oh, let me just finish, though, about this lived immersion.
Oh, uh-huh, okay.
You know, this is what you're describing in your Ohio example, that there was something about that place
that
made you different than being back in the city.
Right.
Now, I don't want to necessarily suggest here that somehow nature is better than civilization or some such thing. I don't think that's the conclusion we want to reach here. We simply want to say that qualities of the world play an integral part in who we are as human beings. Now, Martin Heidegger, the German phenomenologist, called this being in the world, or Dasein. The already, always being caught up in the world at hand. And I think this is something very important for your listeners to ponder, that we are always emplaced in the world. Very interesting how there's no way we can escape this quality, that whether we're in a phone booth or whether we're looking out at the panoramic view from the rim of the Grand Canyon, we're always in place. And this is a central theme in phenomenological research. And while I'm on the topic, let me just mention two wonderful books on this topic. First of all, Edward Ralph's 1976 Phenomenology of Place, called Place and Placelessness. And I recommend that book because it's perhaps the most accessible introduction to a phenomenological approach, particularly a phenomenology of place. So that's called Place and Placelessness. And then the other book I would recommend is a book by philosopher Edward Cayce called Getting Back into Place, mm-hmm. which was published in 1994, but was recently extended in a second edition. But those two works, if any listeners are interested in this material, are very, very enlightening starting points.
Well, when you talk about phenomenologists saying, you know, we are always in a we're in place, do they have a sense of how do I put this? When I started doing Vipassana meditation as an adult, you know, at a certain point, you just perceive that vibratory flux, what's arising and passing away in the mind, and how you can observe sensations arising and passing away in the body. And then in a longer retreat, when you really sharpen your focus, you can, you know, walking to the dining hall, almost see the vibratory flux and the leaves and all the living things. And having that experience reminded me of the immersion in nature at the camp, because it was a visceral continuity between what I perceive as my being and the whole world, the whole living world. And is there that dimension in these phenomenological terms?
Well, of course, this is a highly controversial question. Now, I agree with you. I take the phenomenological position. Let's call this quality that you're speaking of sense of place. Would that be acceptable? There's something.
I need a more organic. These guys aren't striking me as organic enough.
Well, what would you like? What would you call it? Ambience? Would that work?
Yeah. Okay. That's okay.
Let's call it place ambience.
Like a biological ambience. Yeah.
Let's call it place ambience. You see, I personally, as a phenomenologist, believe that this quality of ambience is a real phenomenon. However, if you're a social constructionist, you're going to argue that in fact...
Why am I not? But go ahead.
This ambience is entirely a function of your subjective impression.
And cultural construction, the way you were raised.
Yes. So even among phenomenologists, I think there's quite a bit of controversy here.
Uh-huh.
And it does become a kind of assumption as to whether the ambience is real or whether it's only a product of the individual or group's social construction of the world.
My argument is it sometimes just smacks you upside the head. You know, it's like the opposite of your socialization. That's what happened to me. Anyway, I'm interested to know that there is that debate. I guess I could have figured, but I didn't. And I want to, I need to stop here for the break, pause for the break, but come back to some of these concrete examples and then some of the theory, this generative theory you've worked out. But you were so good, you know, last time about having all these examples at your fingertips because you've been editing this journal about this for 25 years. So let's just pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, David Simon. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, David Simon. He's the editor of the journal Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology, or EAP. And if you want to get to their website, it's a little bit tricky. You have to go through Kansas State University's architecture department. But here's the address, arch.ksu.edu/Seamon/EAP. Well worth the effort. Now,
oh, and Charlene, there's a dot under, after arc, not a forward slash.
There's a dot where?
After arc, A-R-C-H dot.
Ah, okay.
Park.ksu.edu. Yeah, or they can just Google my name, David Seaman, S-E-A-M-O-N. Yeah, it's with an O-N,
yeah,
not an A-N.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, before I get into this again, because this is, you know, a special area within this very, very, very large subject of our culture waking up and sort of breaking out of the encrusted mechanistic worldview to understand that we and everything around us we're all composed of dynamic interrelatedness. So that's what I call relational reality. And I just want to say that I guess reading some of David's pieces kind of sparked my excitement about this again, because after the book Relational Reality was published a couple of years ago, which, as I say, has scores, if not hundreds, of examples of these discoveries that have been made, kind of most of them in the last 10 years. Things like the discovery, if elderly people have very few friends, they lose motor coordination faster than the control group that has more friends, that kind of thing. The correlation between, as I put it, our immune systems are formed in love. There's a study in there about boys at Harvard that were given a survey and said, did your parents love you enough? Did your mother love you enough? Did your father love you enough? This is 1952. Decades later, they do a follow-up, and the ones who did not feel sufficiently loved had a very high incidence of chronic midlife diseases, cancer, alcoholism, heart disease. The ones that answered yes, they did feel well loved by both parents, they were down to only one quarter of that group having a serious midlife disease. So this kind of thing, that our physicality is influenced by relational factors. Now, I just want to say that after the book came out, I kept seeing stories in the newspaper, like on the health pages once a week and elsewhere online, about these discoveries. So I kept collecting them, and I now have a bulging file. And I made a Facebook page when the book came out, and I put 10 examples from the book Relational Reality so you can see the kind of thing I'm talking about. But now I'm going to add every few days another one of the recent studies from my file. And it's too big for any one person to track. That's what I've really realized. I don't read 100 journals. So I would like to invite anyone who's interested in this, who happens to see a media story about a scientific discovery having to do with physical reality being relational, influenced by some kind of relationship, dynamic relationship, to post that on this Relational Reality Facebook page so we can make a clearinghouse and bring a lot of these discoveries together in one place. So anyway, I'll start that tomorrow. The page is up now. It's been up. You can take a look at the 10 examples of discoveries that are up there now, and I'll be adding to it, and I invite anyone to add to it. Just put the full citation of the media article and just a brief summary of what the discovery was, and then if the media article is referring to a scientific journal, put the name of that too and the issue if you can, so people can go look at it. Okay, well, very exciting. David, we aren't going to have enough time to get into everything. I think I'm just going to go through the six processes that you came up with as a theory of generative placemaking, and the fact that you say each one of these can either be sustaining to our experience of place or undermine it. These processes were interaction, identity, release, realization, creation, and intensification. So could you explain how those would enter into whether a place feels alluring to us or not?
Yes, and let me just start by saying that much of my research and writing deals with the underlying lived qualities of place. And certainly we can explore place as a whole, W-H-O-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
we can explore place as a series of lived dialectics. For example, when you think about any place, whether it's a favorite chair or a favorite room or the house in which you live or the neighborhood or the city, there's this lived dialectic between the way it faces inwardly and the way it faces outwardly. So we can talk about place in terms of lived dialectics. Now, lately, I've become very interested in place as process. In other words, how might we portray place as a generative phenomenon? In other words, how places strengthen and weaken over time. And if you think about it, any place has a life history. At some point, it's founded. And it has its ups and downs. And eventually, probably every place on Earth succumbs. And then, of course, we have places like New Orleans, you know, which almost fell apart with Katrina, but slowly it's regenerated itself. Or you think of Chicago after the Great Fire of 1871 and its regeneration. So the question becomes, what are the lived processes whereby places unfold? That's really the question that led me identifying these six place processes. Now, I don't want to go into the justification of why there are six. If anybody is interested, they can email me, and I can send you the article that provides the justification for six. Because, you know, somebody might say, well, why aren't there five? Why aren't there four? Why are there six? And that's a very interesting question, but I don't want to get into it here unless you push me into it. Let me just give your audience a sense of what each of these processes are. Now, I would argue that place interaction is the founding stone of place. And place interaction is nothing but the typical everyday goings-on in a place. So we would be talking about a day in the life of a place. And this is a very interesting question. What are the interactions of a particular place, and how do both human and physical qualities affect those interactions? And that's an issue you were getting to when you were talking about hospital design. But coupled with place interaction is the idea of place identity. And this is the whole question of how people and groups take up place as a significant part of their world. And when you think about it, we almost always automatically identify ourselves by our place. When we introduce ourselves, very often we will say, you know, you're from San Francisco or I'm from Manhattan, Kansas. But that place quality is very often an integral part of who we think we are. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that place identity comes out of those place interactions. Now, there are other interesting dimensions of place, and they include place release. Now, I'm very interested in place release because I don't think it's studied well in the literature. Place release refers to the idea of places incorporating an environmental serendipity. So we're talking about unexpected encounters and events. We're walking down the sidewalk in the central business district, and suddenly we run into somebody we know. But the point is, very often there a place facilitates these unexpected events, encounters, experiences. And in a sense, people are released more deeply into themselves through gaining pleasure from place. So that's what I mean by place release. Now, do you want me to go through the other three? I've talked about interaction, identity, release.
Yeah, interesting. Go ahead.
All right. So we also have what I call realization. And again, this is a quality of place. Well, this gets us back to the question as to whether ambience is socially constructed or a real phenomenon. And I would argue that this ambience is real, and this is what I call place realization, the palpable presence of place, in other words. The place evokes a distinctive ambience. It has a unique character. And certainly we feel this powerfully when we go to a city like Paris or New York. But I would argue that the most mundane of places have a certain amount of realization. And, of course, a key design question is how we use design and planning to strengthen the sense of place ambience. That's a very, very important question.
Is that, widely paid attention to now in the profession?
Well,
community design and redesign?
Talk about a controversy. I would argue no.
I
think the major way of dealing with place ambience today is to generate images, visual images. In other words, architecture and other designs which are edgy, provocative, often shocking.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Gehry's work, I mean, some of Frank Gehry's work is beautiful, but much of the work is edgy in the sense that it looks like it's on the verge of collapsing. You know, it defies gravity, and that's a remarkable thing to be able to do with a building. But for the lay public, this kind of anti-gravity design is often quite troubling. You know, there are stories of people who won't walk beneath a Frank Gehry building because they're worried that it might fall down at any moment. Now, to a sophisticated person, that seems stupid. But, you know, many people aren't that alert to style. Anyway, so that's place realization, and then we have place creation. Now, place creation is the situation where people of the place, out of concern and attachment, imagine and reshape the place in ways that will make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So here we're talking about the power of creative design, planning, policy, law, to strengthen the place and make it a better world for the human beings who are associated with it. And then finally we have place intensification. And again, I think this is so important, and it's largely lost in a lot of the social science literature. And place intensification refers to the independent power of the material environment to contribute to the presence of the place. And there's a sociologist who's called this the agentic capacity of material realities. In other words, lifeless stuff, a bench, for example. Let's talk about park design. Plaza design, where the benches are placed, how many there are, whether there's any sitting at all. This is a way in which the materiality and spatiality of the place contributes to whether there's a powerful sense of place or not. So these are the six aspects. And my point is that each of these processes, they have a constructive dimension, or they have a undermining dimension. So, for example, place interaction. Think about this, and this is happening a lot. Let's say in Detroit, for example, where typical interactions of place become fewer or destructive. So the pleasure of being a part of the place is undermined through discomfort or stress or nuisance or inefficiency or fear. But at the same time, interaction can be wonderful if you feel secure, if you're enjoying going out on the street, just taking in, imbibing the social ambience of a lively street life, for example, if we're talking about an urban environment. So each of these we can talk about in terms of positive and negative aspects.
Oh, yeah, I see. Now that you've described it,
And you see, they all are intertwined. They all fold over on each other.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a very important aspect of the kind of relationality that you're so interested in. You know, all the parts are continually in process.
You
really can't separate them out.
That reminds me of something else I read in one of your papers about this study. We just have a few minutes, but when you were just now talking about a lively urban area or something that's got more relational connections, and there was a study of two different neighborhoods, how they fared in the heat wave in Chicago in the 1990s. What was it, the mid-90s?
Yes, that's true. And this is another book I would recommend to your listeners. This is a book by Eric Kleinberg. Kleinenberg. And he's a sociologist, and in 2002 he published a book called Heat Wave, and it has a curious subtitle, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, because as many listeners may remember, in 1995, in the month of July, there was a five-day period with temperatures over 100 degrees, and over 700 Chicagoans died in that heat wave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the conventional understanding as to why they died was provided by a CDC study, which pointed out that most of the people who died were elderly, they lived alone, they were poor, they had no access to transportation, they probably didn't have air conditioning, they ran out of water, they had medical problems. This was the standard picture of who died. And Kleinenberg, as a sociologist, said, you know, we could also look to see if there are certain social and place qualities which help us explain who died and why. And he did a very clever thing. First of all, he looked at all the data on the various census tracts of Chicago. And eventually he located two neighborhoods which are immediately next to each other. And these neighborhoods had the same level of risk factor, but they had dramatically different death rates. The one neighborhood had a death rate which was about 10 times higher than the other one.
Wow.
And the one neighborhood was North Lawndale, and the other neighborhood was South Lawndale, better known as Little Village. And what Kleinenberg did was to do field study in these two neighborhoods and try to figure out if there were certain place features that helped explain the difference in death rate. And of course,
we have to go. I'm just about out of time here. But can you,
okay. Yeah. So, anyway, so what he finds is there are, yes.
What? Can you quickly say what the features were that he found?
Well, yes. The one neighborhood had fearful old people who rarely left their dwellings because the neighborhood was run down. There was minimal commerce. There were abandoned buildings. There were empty streets, very low residential density, whereas the other neighborhood, which is actually a lively Latino neighborhood, had safe, lively streets. So in those 5 days when there was the heat wave, these folks who were vulnerable, they were quite ready to go out onto the streets in Little Village and find a cool, safe place, whereas the folks who lived in North Lawndale didn't have those place features available. So they stayed in their dwellings. And, well, within 48 hours, if they didn't have air conditioning, their systems were compromised.
Yeah, that was tragic. I remember that.
But it's
a
wonderful example of how we are literally embedded in place. And how qualities of place affect what our world is.
Well, I want to thank you for not only coming on today, but for 25 years of editing EAP Journal. It's now going to be totally online, because in every issue there are these kinds of studies, fascinating perspectives on what we've overlooked, this interrelated dynamic of place and humans in place. So I just think it's a tremendous contribution, and please tell your students if they're interested in relational reality to, if they have anything to contribute to the discussion, about the Facebook page. And thank you so much for coming on the program today.
A pleasure.
Well, let's go on over to the Arts Corner and see what we have. You won't be surprised to find it's all about place. And the first one is actually about a place that never disappoints, and that's a place in nature. If you have a favorite spot, you'll relate. This is a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called Sleeping in the Forest. I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed, nothing between me and the white fire of the stars, but my thoughts, and they floated light as moths along the branches of the perfect trees. All night I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night I rose and fell as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better. And then for our song about place, well, we'll hear Chrissy Hynde wondering, "Hey ho, Ohio, where did you go?" Actually, it's still there. I was just back there last month. So this is the Pretenders with "My City Was Gone." Pretenders with My City Was Gone. Came out 30 years ago this year, but who's counting? Okay, if you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on September 11th with my guest, the environmental journalist, Mark Hertzgard. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now.